The more science we put in front of them, human rights stuff we put in front of them, the more cases of sick people we put in front of them, the more entrenched they become in their determination, absolute and utter determination to keep using glyphosate and roll it out and increase its use. It's the same thing with 1080. The more people have protested against it, the more ruthless the government has become in its determination to blitz the country with it.
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Green Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth.
Kia ora and welcome. I'm Lisa Eyre and this is Green Planet FM. The president of the US National Health Federation, Scott Tipps, tells us our soils are sick from greed-based irresponsible agricultural practices, pesticides, chemical fertilizers, erosion and mineral depletion, all of which stop or reduce adequate microbial activity in the soil, rendering them sick and or dead and sterile. Sick soils make for sick plants, and sick plants make for sick humans and animals. Is that the sort of food that you think that we should be growing and eating in clean, green New Zealand? Today I have in the studio Dr. Meriel Watts, who is an expert on the adverse effects of pesticides and on non-chemical alternatives to them. Meriel gained her PhD at the University of Auckland in 2000 with a thesis entitled Ethical Pesticide Policy, Beyond Risk Assessment. She and her partner run a small certified organic farm on Auckland's Waiheke Island, providing food for the local community. Author of 5 books, Meriel has been working on behalf of civil society for 27 years on the pesticide issues and safer alternatives. Welcome, Meriel. One of the many strings to your bow is being the coordinator of the Pesticide Action Network of New Zealand. Can you begin by telling me about your greatest concern regarding pesticide use in New Zealand?
Well, in terms of individual pesticides, I could mention a number. For example, neonicotinoid insecticides, chlorpyrifos, it's an insecticide, and glyphosate, which is a herbicide. But really my greatest concern is the failure for New Zealand to wake up and look around itself and realise what it's doing, what we are doing to ourselves and our environment, and to realise that overseas things are changing very, very dramatically. We have in this country a mindset that if the government says it's okay to use a chemical, let's go on your head and use it, it's not a problem. We have a registration authority in New Zealand that is, as with many registration authorities, regrettably, is led by politics rather than science. There is science involved in the assessment of the pesticides, but the decisions in the end are political ones. And this is and most people don't realise that. They just think if the government says it's okay to use, it's safe. The government's registration process does not say a pesticide is safe. It says it's acceptable for you to use it. The risks are acceptable, meaning that the benefits outweigh the risks. The benefits to some people outweigh the risks to other people. For example, neonicotinoid insecticides. These are highly toxic insecticides that are used as a seed treatment, particularly around corn seeds, but also other seeds. And when the seed germinates, the insecticide is absorbed into the plant, and the whole plant contains insecticide, which means that it's actually pretty good at not being eaten by pests. Great for the farmer who's growing the crop, the corn. But what happens is those neonic insecticides are taken up throughout the plant, and they're expressed in every part of the plant, including the pollen, the nectar, and those tiny little droplets of water that are expressed on the edges of plants in the early hours of the morning when the vapor pressure falls. Bees drink that water, and they also take the nectar and the pollen. And so the risk to the bees is much, much greater. There's no benefit for the bees or beekeepers or people using neonicotinoids. So So what we have is a situation where we have a government that looks only at what might be of benefit to the group of farmers, and the farmers are using it. That great, this will help us with our corn. But somebody else is carrying the risks. We're all carrying the risks, actually, because these chemicals are highly toxic. But the bees and beekeepers are carrying much greater risk than anybody else. And our system doesn't really take adequate notice of that.
I'm actually a little bit shocked because I'm thinking, well, you know, I must be eating that then.
You most likely are. I can't tell you what the levels in our honey are. I've never actually seen an analysis of it, but I would imagine that there would be some. There certainly is very persistent in the environment. There was a very interesting study carried out by Auckland University's technology last year, or possibly earlier this year, I'm sorry, I can't remember the date, where they measured the level of several of the neonic insecticides in the soil in corn patches around the country, in three parts of the country. And they measured them 1 year after the seeds had been sown, and they found high levels of residue still in the soil just before another lot of seeds with another lot of neonic was going to be sown, indicating that we're getting increasing levels of this stuff in the soil every year. And, of course, you get a dry year and you've got the soil blowing around, that insecticide is also blowing around, as well as being taken up into the plants and then into the bees and into the honey.
And so are these, you mentioned corn, but are these used in, say, gardening products?
This is a great difficulty for us. Yes, they are used in some gardening products. Here on Waiheke Island, some of our Green Party group has been very active in making sure that none of them are sold on the island, so that's great. Can't tell you about the rest of the country, unfortunately. But those are labelled products that you can buy off the shelf. We know about those. What we don't know is what seeds contain this treatment, because our law in New Zealand does not require treated seeds to be labelled as such. So I spent some time doing a bit of research a few years back to try and figure out which of our seeds in New Zealand are treated with neonics, and I could not find an answer. I tried, because they're not labelled, I tried the major seed sellers, seed manufacturers, the purveyors, and they weren't going to tell me. They literally were not going to tell me, because it's a secret. So farmers will buy seeds knowing that they're treated, but they don't know what chemicals are used on in that treatment. So and home gardeners buying seeds, it's very difficult. If you buy a packet of seeds and open it and find you've got brightly coloured seeds, they've been treated with something, but you won't know what it is. It could be a neonic insecticide, it could be a carcinogenic fungicide. Those are the most likely prospects, possibly some other kind of insecticide. Most likely it's a carcinogenic fungicide. So my advice to people is do not use seeds that are treated. If you find a packet of seeds that are brightly coloured, chuck them out. We've got a certified organic farm, so we're not allowed to use treated seeds, and I have to go to extraordinary lengths sometimes when I can't find certified organic seeds to try and find seeds that are not treated. I recently was looking to get a packet of seeds of lavender dentata because we have a lavender hedge. Bees love it in winter. Clearly we don't want seeds that are treated to grow a lavender hedge. I found a packet that I understood to be not treated. I opened it and the seeds were orange. Now, I've never seen orange seeds on a lavender bush. So clearly it was treated with something and I had to toss them out.
Right. It's quite a worry really for us to find out all these things. And I would have thought, you know, like food, if we're growing anything for food, things should be labelled.
You would hope so.
It's the same idea, you know, we should be allowed to know what's in our food. We should be allowed to know what's in our seeds.
That's correct. And this loophole is really... it's been drawn to the attention of the government, so they're very aware of it. It's not just an oversight, it's quite deliberate. It enables pesticides to be used in ways that people are not aware of. And it's a deliberate exposing of us to pesticides that we're not going to be able to argue about because we don't know about them, so just go ahead and use the seeds. It helps it's just another sales area for pesticides.
What about the Environment Protection Authority, the EPA?
Yes. What about them?
Well, I know they're no use in the US, but what about New Zealand?
Well, let me give you an example of my experiences with them. Some years ago, they decided to reassess all of the organophosphate insecticides, and there's quite a large number of those. And they decided to do them all at once because they're known to have additive effects. So if you're eating one organophosphate pesticide and then another one, you're getting basically double the poison. That they recognise and everybody else recognises. So they decided to reassess them all at once. There was one particular... all of the organophosphate insecticides are majorly toxic and they're a major problem for us. We should not be using any of them in this country. But one that particularly concerned me was chlorpyrifos. It's one of the most widely used of our insecticides, widely used all over the world except for a few countries like Sri Lanka and Yemen that have banned it. And one of the, and US has just tried to ban it. US has been through a very, very, very long reassessment process. I analysed a lot of data showing, from their studies that they've carried out in California, showing that children, small children who have been exposed to chlorpyrifos in utero, in other words through their mother's cord blood, are suffering intellectual development problems, lowered IQ, behavioural problems, cognitive problems, a whole range of those things. There's been an enormous number of studies. As a result of those studies, the US EPA decided to ban chlorpyrifos until, of course, Donald Trump was elected and he put in charge one of his friends, Scott Pruitt, and Scott Pruitt said, no, we won't ban it. And that was partly because Dow Chemical gave $1 million to Donald Trump's inauguration process. Now, I'm telling you this ahead of telling you what happened in New Zealand, although New Zealand happened first, just to give you an indication of the level of political interference in policy-making decisions when it comes to pesticides. In New Zealand, it's not nearly as obvious, but it still happens. So, back to chlorpyrifos in New Zealand, I put in a 76-page submission detailing all of those studies in the US that the US EPA had said were a major concern and reason for banning it, together with a lot of information showing that chlorpyrifos is winding up in both the Arctic and probably the Antarctic, although it's not been measured there. It's what's known as a persistent organic pollutant. It's very persistent in the environment at certain temperatures, and it bioaccumulates in wildlife, and it's very toxic. And so what has happened, of course, is that large levels that have been, high levels have been found in the Arctic. We don't know whether they have in the Antarctic because no one's tested. We do know it's found in the air over the Southern Alps, possibly on the way to the Antarctic. So I put all this information into our US EPA, plus an alternative for every single one of the known uses of chlorpyrifos in New Zealand. And these are alternatives that are already being used by farmers in New Zealand. And the outcome was farmers need to have chlorpyrifos. Nothing wrong with the product. Keep on using it. They completely ignored all of the alternatives I gave them. They ignored all of the studies on children that the US EPA had said were showing it to be a significant problem. And they didn't even look at whether it was a persistent bioaccumulative or likely to end up in the Antarctic. They didn't even study that part of it. It was a very, very poor assessment. And when they reported on the submissions that people had put in, all they said about the 76-page submission I put in was that I was worried about children. And so the one thing they did do was they decided that homeowners wouldn't be allowed to use chlorpyrifos in their homes anymore. They could employ somebody else to come in and poison their kids, but they weren't allowed to do it themselves. So as a result of that, I have very little engagement with our EPA here in New Zealand because they clearly do not make assessments based on science. The science very clearly showed here and in the US, that chlorpyrifos is way too hazardous to be used anymore. But politics got in the way. And so they say the farmers need to have it so they can have it.
Would you say that there's some bribery going on? Who makes chlorpyrifos?
Dow Chemical Company makes it. Certainly there's, there's very blatant bribery in the US. Dow was one of, the chief executive of Dow was one of Donald Trump's transition team. He heads the White House manufacturing group. And as I said, he gave $1 million to Donald Trump's inauguration. I mean, you can't get much more blatant bribery than that. I don't think in New Zealand we have the same sort of bribery as that going on, but we have an institutional political view that we must have pesticides, and if farmers want to have pesticides, they can have it, and we'll shuffle the decisions around to ensure that they can have it.
And maybe there's a bit of an old boys club too.
Yes, I think so.
Dow Chemicals, I know they've got a factory in Henderson. And New Plymouth is where they manufactured some ghastly chemicals for the Vietnam War, was
it? Correct. In New Plymouth, they manufactured 245T and 24D. And there was tremendous problem in New Plymouth and Taranaki with the contamination of the environment with the dioxin that came from the 245T manufacture. Dow buried it in drums on their farmland just near to their Paratutu chemical works. Unfortunately for them, the cliff eroded. and the drums ended up on the beach down below, and there were puddles of raw chemical lying on the rocks down below. A TV cameraman, I think it was, who found lots of dead birds sort of floating in these puddles of chemical. Totally irresponsible company, like most of the pesticide companies, all of them really. Their main concern is making money, and they will hide whatever data and evidence they need to in order to continue to make that money.
And I've noticed that Bayer and Monsanto have just filed a $66 billion merger for approval.
Yes.
So that would be kind of becoming closer to a monopoly over our food supply.
That's right. And Syngenta and ChemChina have joined hands, along with Adama in Israel, so that we're really down to only a couple of mega-sized chemical companies in the world.
So we really have to throw this open to the farmers to be ethical about the stuff they use, isn't it? Because going through government channels when you've got these powerful influencers is obviously difficult.
It's a very difficult process. The whole approach to pesticides has to change in this country, from home garden use to household use to farm use. It's a bit rich of us as consumers to say you farmers should stop using pesticides on your food if you're spraying a fly spray in your house. Fly sprays are based on synthetic pyrethroids, insecticides, and they cause cancer. But it's extraordinary how many people still use them in their houses. So whilst we're still using these chemicals, and we're still using chemicals in our home gardens, we don't have much of a right to say to farmers, you should stop putting them on our food. Change has to come from us, everybody, consumers as well as farmers. Many, many farmers in this country are making changes. Many of them are farming organically, biologically, biodynamically, call it what you want to. There's a range of different approaches, but they're all essentially focusing on a healthy plant coming in from a healthy soil. And when you have a healthy plant from healthy soil, you don't have a problem with pests and diseases. So there are many farmers doing that. There needs to be a lot more joining them. We need all of our farmers to join them in doing that. One of the biggest problems we have in this country, and this takes me back to where I started with what's the biggest problem with pesticide, is political will. We don't have the political will in this country to say enough is enough with pesticides and let's help our farmers to find a better way forward. It's happening everywhere around the world, but it's not happening in New Zealand. And this is the key thing coming up to an election, yet another election, where we should be having politicians who are brave enough to take this on, come up with a decent agricultural policy that's not focused on the dependence on pesticides.
And we haven't really got a party that's really taking it on, apart from Stephen Browning and the Greens.
No, not really. That I've seen. There may be some good stuff tucked away in people's portfolios, but they're not talking about it. Until people start talking about it, we won't get any change.
And, of course, there's a lot of people making a noise about 1080,
yes,
which obviously is having the same problem with the EPA and with the information from the government that you're having with the other pesticides.
Yes.
And the Greens don't stand up against that.
No, and that's true, unfortunately. And so similar, what we're seeing with the 1080 is similar to what we're seeing with glyphosate in Auckland on Auckland Street. Auckland City Council had a 40-year ban on using Roundup on city streets, and we use hot water and a variety of other non-chemical methods to control weeds perfectly adequately. Then Auckland Council came and took over the whole area, amalgamated seven cities. And ever since then, there's been this almighty fight to try and stop them spraying again where it's not necessary to spray, where we've had non-chemical treatments for 14 or more years. And the more science we put in front of them, human rights stuff we put in front of them, the more cases of sick people we put in front of them, the more entrenched they become in their determination, absolute and utter determination to keep using glyphosate and roll it out and increase its use. It's the same thing with 1080. The more people have protested against it, the more ruthless the government has become in its determination to blitz the country with it.
Yes, yes. Well, my previous interview was with Clyde Graff on 1080, so...
Yes.
And, yeah, I picked up a lot about that, and that's why I actually then thought, no, we've got to look at the other chemicals that are being dropped on New Zealand as well. Not just 1080, but all of them, because... Well, how I got interested in this is through making hummus, and I was given lots of opportunities as to preservatives that I could put into the hummus. And I looked at these and I thought, well, okay, it says that any person can have this much preservative, but what if they're eating it in other foods too?
Yeah.
So I said, no, I don't want to use them, thank you very much. And that kind of opened my eyes to the fact that we can be massively overdosed with what they call the safe dose.
That's true. We could be eating, if you're not eating organic food, you could be eating anything like 17 pesticides in your dinner tonight. I have done some analysis on some of the total diet surveys and what's found in an average dinner, and you could be eating that many pesticides. Now, when they say it's okay, it's safe, they look at each single pesticide by itself, and they judge its safety on the average healthy 70 kilogram man. They do not judge it on the pregnant woman whose small child might be exposed at the most vulnerable time of development to a brain-altering chemical like chlorpyrifos. The levels of chlorpyrifos in cord blood that alter the structure of brains is something like 1/1,000,000,000th of a gram. It's minuscule, way, 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 way smaller than the levels that we have in our food. But they don't look at those studies when they register a chlorpyrifos, so they don't have to worry about whether it's going to cause brain damage in children or not, because that's outside of their regulatory requirements. They just say it's safe without actually having examined those studies. And you put that, a chlorpyrifos might be in, for example, in your potatoes or something, might be in something or other, one of the greens you're eating tonight, you might get a double dose of it. No. And then you put another 4 or 5 different fungicides into you with that, which might be carcinogenic. What's that doing? We don't know. They don't know. They'll say it's safe because they don't know.
That's shocking, isn't it?
And
the other thing that they're doing with the potatoes, I believe, is spraying them with glyphosate or Roundup before they're harvested, so it kills the greenery.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, I just read a very interesting study today about the use of glyphosate and paraquat on chickpeas. One of the things they've discovered is if you spray those glyphosate, particularly on chickpeas, before the peas are harvested, they cook quicker. Isn't that great? They'll break down quicker. Great. So what else are these things doing to our food? You know, what we need in this country is everyone to wake up and realise that we alone are responsible for our health. We cannot rely on anybody to ensure our food is safe. We cannot rely on anybody to ensure that they know what's going on with the chemicals that we're all exposed to. We're the only ones who can take responsibility for what we put into our bodies, and we have to do that. Because you see the epidemics of cancer in New Zealand and around the world, the epidemics of Parkinson's disease, of birth defects, lowered IQ. There's what's called a silent pandemic of developmental, neurodevelopmental disorders been identified in the United States. And organophosphate pesticides are one of the key causes of that, along with lead. And what it's doing is causing a shift in the IQ of about 5% across the country. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but when you take away 5%, if you skew the whole thing by the whole bell chart of intelligence by 5% to the left, the lower end, you dramatically reduce the number of gifted people in the country by about 50%. And you increase the number of people with subnormal intelligence by about 50%. And that's just by a small shift in IQ. And when we know that chlorpyrifos is causing this small shift in IQ, how can we possibly allow children or pregnant women to be eating food with them?
And fluoride causes a shift in the IQ as well.
Here we are. Cook your food in fluoridated water with a bit of chlorpyrifos added into it. What's the combined effect of that? We don't know.
No. It's absolutely shattering, really. It's so irresponsible. I mean, you know, once upon a time it was okay to smoke. Scientists said, yes, fine, and they said it was okay to take thalidomide.
Yeah.
And now they've said, oops, there was a mistake. Yeah. Well, how many mistakes are we living with now?
Yeah, and the pesticide industry uses the same arguments as the tobacco industry. They know what's going on, but they've got money to make.
Right. And this is the neoliberal Milton Friedman kind of idea that a business must be making a lot of money.
And that what we've heard over these last decade or so from the national government, we can't have a nanny state, you know, that's a term they sling out with anybody suggest any kind of regulation. No, no, no to nanny states. Well, actually, it's exactly what we need. We need a state that will look after its people, not expose it to chemicals. Say, oh, don't worry, it's okay, you'll be safe.
Yes, well, when I stood for the Greens in 2008 and I was at a political meeting and the people there, mostly national voters, were giving Phil Goff a hard time about the nanny state, and then a bit later they started going on about the leaky homes.
Yeah.
And so I asked for the microphone and I said, excuse me, if you're going to talk about government regulation and leaky homes, then you have to understand that that would be nanny state.
Yeah.
That stopped all the, you know,
what we desperately need in this country is nanny state, a state that actually cares about the people, not about foreign corporations making huge profits.
Yes, exactly, and not even insisting that they pay tax in this country.
That's right.
Yes, so it's a very sad situation that we're living in, and we need people to wake up and do what they can at election time and in between elections.
Yes, yes. We have to help ourselves at our own level, and by helping ourselves, it sends a very strong market signal. But we also have to make demands of our politicians that enough is enough. I think New Zealand First policy on agriculture might be worth looking at. I actually got asked to write it last year, but I couldn't do it because I was too busy. But I believe that they are heading in the right direction with their agricultural policy. So I think everybody should be actually focusing not just on rates and tax increases or decreases or how much is going to be spent on education or housing, but actually have a look at some of the stuff that is not usually broadcast during election year, but which can deeply affect all of us in terms of our health and our educational abilities and our abilities to function as a society into the future. I mean, I worry about the impact of pesticides on Parkinson's disease and cancer in this country, but I worry even more about where it's leading us as a society. If we're dumbing ourselves down and dumbing the kids down and dumbing everything down, things will just get worse and worse and worse.
Well, I think you've just persuaded me to eat entirely organic. I don't at the moment. I eat a mixture. But, yes, after listening to you there, I think, yes, I've got to get back to entirely organic food. And the more, of course, the more organic food that we eat, the more that's sold, the quicker the turnover,
that's right.
The more that actually the prices can be brought down.
And the more the farmers will grow it.
Yes.
The more that the supermarkets will say, where is the organic food? We want organic food. And start making the call to the government to help the organic sector.
Yes, yes. Because, I mean, at the moment, the prices have to be a wee bit higher because you get more wastage, which is understandable. But what are some of the things that you use to assist you in your own farm on Waiheke?
Well, our focus is on creating healthy soil and a healthy environment so we don't have pest and disease problems. We very, very rarely ever have a disease problem. Occasionally on a wet summer we've had problems with mildew on the onions, and so we've used a biological control spray, it's a bacillus similar to BT, to control that. Pests, we just don't have very many pests anymore. We did initially, but as the soil improves through using compost, and we do soil tests to see whether we've got any nutritional deficiencies and then address those when we do with organic fertilisers. But the main focus is on compost, mulching and bokashi, an effective microorganism. Bokashi composting, which helps to increase the effective microorganisms in the soil. We use worm farming too to help create more beneficial microflora in the soil. That helps plants to take up the nutrients. So the key thing is creating a healthy soil. You can't just go and buy a bag of potting mix from the supermarket, from the garden centre, and hope that you'll get healthy vegetables out of it. You won't. It's dead. You need to create a healthy soil through composting your own scraps and your own food scraps and garden waste. If you're not using any chemicals in your garden, you can get some really good compost from the weeds that are there.
I'm speaking with Dr. Mariel Watts, who is the author of a book, Replacing Chemicals with Biology, Phasing Out Highly Hazardous Pesticides with Agroecology. And this is Green Planet FM.
101 things that can be said about it.
Well, there's the answer lies in the soil is an old saying from a long time ago.
Yeah, absolutely it does. And, you know, there's nothing more wonderful than going out and getting fresh vegetables out of the garden. Fresh peas off the plant, they seldom make it inside to get cooked. They get eaten on the way back to the house. But the best thing of all is fresh sweet corn. We grow sweet corn for ourselves. We don't usually sell it because we're a bit greedy, I'm afraid. But we do sell it sometimes. But put the pot on to boil, go down to the garden and pick the corn and stick it straight in the pot, and 10 minutes later eat your corn. It's nothing like what you buy in a shop. It's so sweet. And you can only get it like that if you grow it yourself.
That sounds really wonderful, actually.
It is.
And the peas, I remember doing that as a child.
Yeah.
And when, you know, my dad used to grow things. But, of course, you know, life now is quite stressful for everybody, sitting in traffic for an hour each way to work and this sort of thing in Auckland. And so it's hard to have time to do all of these things. So we do need to have our organic food farmed. I mean, I don't have...
Absolutely.
I've got carry trees in my back garden, and to get a good garden, I'd have to chop them down to get sunlight, which
That's
I'm
true.
Not prepared to do.
I'm sorry, you won't be able to have fresh sweet corn then, but I understand that.
Yes.
But you're perfectly right. If you can't grow it yourself, or what you can't grow yourself, and most of them can grow something themselves, even if it's just a pot of tomatoes on the deck, then get it from an organic shop.
I certainly do have tomatoes on the deck, yes, and a few other bits and pieces. Actually, the New World had a really good scheme. They gave you, when you spent a certain amount of money, a little plant to grow.
Awesome.
And I popped them into pots and grew them, and it kind of gave me confidence to do vegetable gardening in pots in my courtyard.
Well, that's great.
Yeah, so I was quite pleased with that.
There's a wonderful farming movement in India, in urban India, where they are teaching people to grow food in big bags just on their patios, on their rooftops, and etc. And then they have mobile organic clinics where people will come around and give you advice on what you need to do from an organic perspective. You know, there's some wonderful ideas and opportunities like that that we could have in New Zealand, but nobody's doing them so far. There's opportunities for everybody there.
Yes, yes, I think there are. And, of course, in France, they have beehives on the skyscrapers.
Yes, and in New York, too.
Right. Mm. But you have to make sure, of course, that you have flowers up there as well.
You do need flowers there as well. But, you know, there are enormous opportunities for growing within our urban areas, even if it's also community-supported gardens. It's another way. Unfortunately, we have a bit of a problem with it. Our council in Auckland sometimes being a little too liberal with the sprays near community organic gardens. It's another issue that they don't take seriously.
Well, yes, they're still very much into using glyphosate because a relative of mine has just got a job, and that will unfortunately be her job. She has a master's in chemistry, and I can't say she's exactly thrilled about it, but there's a shortage of jobs, and this is what happens when you're desperately need a job.
Well, let's hope that she can try and persuade them to change their minds about some of it if she has the right information to give them.
Yes. Certainly, my son at one point had to do that, and they didn't like him wearing protective gear.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Because it didn't look good to the public.
Oh, that's outrageous.
Mm.
But that's indicative of their attitude, is that they don't want to know whether there's a problem, and if there is, they want to sweep it under the carpet and pretend everything's fine.
Well, when they come round and spray the roadsides, and then after school the children might be rolling around on it.
Yes.
It's drastically serious, in my opinion.
It is drastically serious. It's a pretty lethal chemical that way. It's not an immediate fall over dead chemical, but the long-term impacts of it are pretty horrific. And it's just not being taken seriously in this country because the politics. I mean, who could contemplate the farmers being without glyphosate? It's just too frightening for them. So they will use every which way they can to argue that the science says it's not carcinogenic, when in fact the science is very, very clear. It is carcinogenic. There's not a doubt about it. But when they start to bring in the politics around it, things get very muddied.
Well, the soil has got very depleted, hasn't it, with the current form of farming. I mean, I remember at high school we were taught about how farmers used to rotate crops and then leave a field fallow and things like that.
Yes.
Which was the old-fashioned way of doing it, wasn't it?
It's also the modern organic way of doing it because it's actually very important to rotate your crops. If you grow the same crop in the same soil year after year, you will no doubt have a pest and disease problem. So we have to pay quite close attention to which crops follow each other and when a bed needs spelling or farm or a paddock needs spelling to allow it to regenerate itself.
I have a school friend in the Lake District who has an organic farm in England, and the government pays, the British government pays for one field to be fallow each year, organic field. So it covers the cost for a farmer to do that. And in the field that she had there were so many wildflowers. It was just beautiful.
It must have been lovely, and the bees would have been terribly happy.
Very much so, yes.
Because side effect, not only do they get paid, they get good honey as well if they had beehives. Yes, we, of course, have nothing like that in New Zealand because we don't believe in supporting farmers with money, but we do. We don't believe in pointing them in the direction of organics, but we do believe in pointing them in the direction of high-tech, intensive, chemical-based farming.
Right. So, yes, so we must, as consumers, spend our dollars in appropriate ways.
Consumers have the ultimate power, both in terms of how we spend our dollars and how we vote.
Yes. But we have to be able to use that, and yes. Of course, spending when people are short of money, spending our dollars in that way is a slight problem. So then it's letters to politicians, I think.
Yes, that too.
So we've talked about glyphosate and neonicotinoids. I can never say that word. And the cloth.
Chlorpyrifos.
Is there any other ghastly thing that's being used widespread in New Zealand that you can tell me about?
Well, there are lots of other pesticides that are really concerning, but there's so many of them that it's not much point going into them. One of them, for example, would be chloroethylenol. That's a fungicide. It's carcinogenic. It's actually used in quite a number of garden centre rose sprays, I seem to recall, plus it's on our food. But that's just one of many. There are so many.
It's shattering.
The Pan International has developed a list of what's called highly hazardous pesticides. These are based on criteria that have been developed by the UN World Health Organization and the Food and Agriculture Organization, plus a few criteria that we've added about bee toxicity and endocrine disruption. And there's about, from memory, about 300 pesticides on that list. About 100 of them are still registered in New Zealand and used in New Zealand. So we are using very toxic pesticides. And interestingly, talking about international, there is a very big movement occurring internationally now to phase all these highly hazardous pesticides out at a global level. New Zealand is way, way, way behind the rest of the world in acknowledging the problems of these pesticides and doing something about them. There was a report by a UN special rapporteur on the right to food that was made to the Human Rights Council earlier this year, the UN Human Rights Council, and in it she's called for a global legally binding treaty to manage pesticides because of the immense problems that are being experienced with poisonings around the world and the damage to ecosystems, including to bees, and the immense power that the pesticide industry holds over governments in terms of preventing them from banning chemicals or from reassessing them. And so this is now quite widely acknowledged at an international level, but New Zealand is really not aware of it, unfortunately.
There's somebody, Molly, somebody who has is trying to get an ecocide law, international ecocide law. Do you know about that?
No, I don't.
But I assume that that would include pesticides along with other things. But you've been involved with the PAN, the Pesticide Action Network, in Malaysia as well, have you?
Yes, I'm employed, well, as a consultant to the Asia-Pacific Regional Centre of PAN. PAN's an international network organised around five regional centres, and I work with the one based in Malaysia, the Asia-Pacific region one, and I've been with it since 1991, actually, one capacity or another. So that's where all my work... My work in New Zealand is limited by the fact that there is no money available for work on pesticides in New Zealand, and I have to, like everybody else, earn a living. And also because it's so hard to make any impact in this country, whereas internationally there's much more happening. There's much more openness to understanding the problems with pesticides and much more willingness to address the issues. New Zealand is still really, I'd say, 10, maybe 20 years behind the international progress on understanding where things are at with pesticides. We just have a very, very entrenched attitude within our Ministry of Primary Enterprises and within our farming situation. So that's another reason why I've chosen lately to work more at an international level than here. But we are making good progress with understanding what needs to change at international level. There's a voluntary international agreement called Strategic Approach to International Chemicals Management. 170 countries have signed up to that. New Zealand hasn't, not taking any notice of it. But that international agreement has formally recommended that highly hazardous pesticides be phased out and replaced with agroecology. We would not as organics in this country. But that's a formal UN recommendation, and New Zealand is not even aware of it because New Zealand doesn't even go to those meetings.
That is shocking.
That's shocking.
Who should it be? The Minister of Agriculture who should be going?
The Minister of Agriculture, Minister of Environment and Minister of Health should all be involved.
Oh, goodness. So who's the Minister of Agriculture?
Good question.
We don't even hear about him, do we?
Nathan Guy, I think.
Oh, gosh. Okay. And then you've got Nick Smith for the Environment and...
Jonathan Coleman?
Yes, for Health. Yeah. Well, yes, maybe we could get through to Jonathan Coleman.
Yes.
So, your book, Replacing Chemicals with Biology.
Yes.
Phasing Out Highly Hazardous Pesticides with Agroecology.
Yes.
That's your most recent book.
That is the most recent one. It was actually written specifically for this process that I've just been referring to, the Strategic Approach to International Chemicals Management. And it was instrumental in getting the global agreement that highly hazardous pesticides should be phased out and replaced with agroecology. So sometimes one has to do an awful lot of work, like writing a book, to get one recommendation through, and that's essentially what I did, and that was the outcome. And but it's now widely recognised. And, you know, working at the international level, it's a very incremental process. You take one step forward and then another step and then another step. You don't get massive change overnight. But each step is actually really important, and it gives you something to build on for the next step. So I really value each of the decisions like that that get made where they say, yes. Because up until, that was just last year, up until then we had no global agreement that we have a problem with pesticides, and now we have that agreement. So that's quite in itself quite massive. The fact that New Zealand is absent from the meeting and probably doesn't read the report is shameful, actually. 176 countries there. But not New Zealand. Australia, the US, Canada, Britain, Europe, all the developing countries, everybody else. But not New Zealand.
That is absolutely shattering and should really be publicised, I think, as much as possible. Is there a website, I don't suppose you've got it offhand, where we could get this report?
I can direct you to that, yes.
If you would, then I can put it at least on for those people who are listening on the internet.
Yes.
And this interview will be on greenplanetfm.com, so you can hear it again, and we'll put it on there.
And I will also give you the website for the UN Special Rapporteur's report on pesticides, because that is a major breakthrough. That's the first time someone at the UN level has called for a global legally binding treaty on pesticides.
Right. Right. And it will be a big shift in agriculture, particularly in the West. I guess, I mean, you're advising Malaysia. Well, Malaysia has a lot more, I suppose, local agriculture.
Well, I'm not actually advising Malaysia. It's just that the office I work with is centred in Malaysia.
So, oh, sorry, yes.
Yeah, so it's certainly, but there is a tremendous amount of work going on in developing countries assisting farmers to get off pesticides, because that's where the poisonings have been the worst and most obvious. So a lot of work is going into that, and that's great, that's as it should be. But New Zealand and Australia and the US and Canada and the European countries all have the capacities to change our agriculture ourselves without requiring the UN to show us how to do it. We have good organic farmers right throughout this country who can lead the way, but they're just not given the policy space to do it. It's not even a matter of money so much as a government that's supportive of saying, yes, this is a direction. So like the UN saying we need to phase out highly hazardous pesticides and replace them with agroecology, that's not a money thing, although there will be some money eventually. But that's a policy direction that everybody has to sit up and take notice of. We just don't have a government that can do that. If we had a government, hopefully we'll get a change of government, and if it's got the courage to say we have to radically change our agriculture. Yes, we know we've got problems with dirty waterways, but we've got a lot more problems than that. We need to look at how we can together change our agriculture in this country to reduce the contamination of the environment, reduce the risk to human health, and at the same time make more money out of it. I mean, there's a lot more money to be made out of green agriculture, if you want to call it that way, biodynamics, organics, than there is out of the usual commodities we produce.
I'm also wondering if a way of approaching it would be to actually test the food for what they're supposed to, the levels of vitamins and minerals they're supposed to have. Because I was told that somebody tested an orange in Australia and found there wasn't any vitamin C in it.
Goodness me. That'd be a bit of a shock. There have been a number of studies done comparing conventionally chemically grown food and organically grown food for a range of things, and the results are all over the place, quite frankly. Some find higher vitamin C, some don't. One area they do all agree in is a higher level of polyphenols. Now, polyphenols are naturally occurring chemicals in plants like the orange and carrots, and like the stuff that flavours broccoli, the chemicals in broccoli that create the flavour, that's actually a polyphenol. Those polyphenols are very, a lot of them anyway, are very protective against cancer and other chronic disease problems. So what they've found is that organic foods are much higher in those levels of chemicals, and that's probably of more importance than whether they've got the same amount of vitamin C or B or whatever.
Right. Because, I mean, the minerals, a vitamin and mineral industry is booming, isn't it? Because people are worried that they're not getting what they should from their food.
And they're not, because the food has become so denatured through chemical use.
Yes. So we're back to really the condition of the soil again.
Yes, we are.
So maybe pressuring government to have a department that goes around farms and tests soil. Maybe that would be one way to approach.
Well, great
situation.
I think if there was increased access to soil testing, but then there's a necessity to understand how. A lot of farmers do get their soil tested for mineral levels now, but they're not necessarily translating into mineral levels in plants. It's not the minerals absence or presence in the soil that's the problem. It's whether we've got enough microorganisms to get them taken up into the plant. That's much more important. So it'd be better to have a department that went around checking our microorganism levels in soil to see if we've got a soil that's actually functioning healthily.
Yes, yes, that was sort of what I meant, actually. I didn't describe it.
But I don't think a government department in that respect is what would be needed. What is really needed is an understanding at a national level and a national conversation about what we need to do to improve the health of our soils and the health of the quality of our food.
And you've been speaking out, as we said at the beginning, for 27 years and not being listened to. Where are the other scientists?
In this country?
Yes.
Probably gone off to find jobs somewhere else.
Given up.
Well, it's a difficulty. NGOs don't get funding in this country. We have a small number of dedicated NGO people who work despite the odds to try and bring some sense to this discussion. But unfortunately, with Stefan departing from Parliament, that leaves one less voice in a paid position who can help us. It's very difficult to get that kind of conversation going in this country. What we desperately need is that change at a government level.
Well, that's certainly something to say loudly before an election, and it's certainly up to us as consumers to write to our politicians and say, hey, what's happening with your policies? You know, what are you doing to address this? Because it's really important.
Yeah.
You mentioned before waterways. Now, of course, the stuff leaching into the waterways will make a difference as to why we have poor quality water, won't it?
Yes, in terms of both pesticides and fertiliser nutrients like phosphate and nitrates, but pesticides in waterways are a problem for us as well.
That's killing fish and allowing...
It does all sorts of things. Let me use glyphosate as an example, and this is one of my key concerns about glyphosate, quite apart from whether it's causing cancer in people or not. Glyphosate has the ability to completely destabilise aquatic environments. It increases the growth of some algae and can cause algal blooms, and it decreases other microscopic members of the aquatic communities. So it creates a destabilisation of the whole aquatic community. I don't know if you remember, but some years ago we had a problem with toxic poisoning on the Hauraki Gulf. Dogs were eating things on the beach. It was causing them to get very ill.
Yes.
And nobody ever got to the bottom of what it was. There was some concern about, did some 1080 get tipped overboard when they were dropping it on Motutapu and wash ashore?
I think it was Brodificum, yeah.
Brodificum, okay. Nobody got to the bottom of what it was, and the whole thing died a death without anyone ever identifying what it was. One of the things that glyphosate can do is destabilise the environment to the extent that it gives rise to the growth of some toxic elements and kills off some of the beneficial elements or organisms in the aquatic environment. It's quite possible that the glyphosate that we were pouring and continue to pour into Auckland Harbour was part of that problem. I don't know if it was or not. I don't know if anybody ever tested it. We'll never know. We do know that there's a lot of glyphosate in Auckland Harbour. NIWA tested the sediment in Auckland Harbour some years ago, and they identified glyphosate as a level of concern because of the residues in the sediment right around Auckland, up north to Milford, and a number of streams as well.
Do you know about the Manukau?
Do I know about the Manukau? No, I don't. They didn't test it, but I'm sure that it would be the same there as well. It's washing off the roads from roadside use. So I'm concerned about the long-term impacts of those, whether that's what has caused the increase in toxic algal blooms that we get periodically in Auckland Harbour now and all around the country, or not, I don't know. It could do. But we're not looking. We're not trying to figure it out. We're ignoring it. When I point out these problems, I say, oh, don't worry about that, doesn't matter. It does matter, because we're destabilising our aquatic environment by continually pouring in of chemicals that kill off some species and not others.
Is it because we've got lack of funding for scientists to do that?
No, it's because we don't have... it's one way. We don't have independent scientists who will do that work. We have government-funded scientists who will not want to have their funding spent on things like that.
I see.
In the US, they have enormous amount of independent science funding, and they have a funding institutions that enable all sorts of independent scientific funding to be carried out, research to be carried out, and we just don't have that capacity in New Zealand. But we do have the capacity to look at what they do and learn from the results. However, we don't. Whenever I've talked about what's happening and what might happen in New Zealand, they say, oh, well, there's no information on it in New Zealand, so we don't need to worry about it.
Well, I think that possibly the thing that 176 countries attended the meeting of, now what was it?
SICEM, the Strategic Approach to International Chemicals Management.
And New Zealand didn't go.
New Zealand's not part of it. Quite frankly, from an international perspective, I'm pleased New Zealand's not part of it because they'd try and undo what we're doing. I'm sad for New Zealand that our government is not understanding what's going on.
Yes, yes.
And doesn't care enough to actually take part in it.
So we've just got a couple more minutes now, Mariel. What would you really like to say to New Zealanders about this and how we can move forward? Because I really think, if we could use this interview to alert people, this could be helpful.
New Zealand really has to wake up to what's going on with conventional farming in this country. There was a program recently, there's conversations called What's Next. Remember, there was discussions about what our future might look like. And when they talked about agriculture, they talked about more of the same, but just more tech-savvy, applying your chemicals smarter. That is not the answer for New Zealand. We have to move away from this chemical-intensive approach to an agroecological approach where we base our farming on biology, not on chemicals. And until we do that, we will continue to have problems with our environment and with our health.
And in fact, what if we could overall improve on the agriculture, we would save on the health?
We could save a huge amount of money on our health bills if we produced healthy food and got it to people who need it, who are currently living on cheap junk food instead of good, healthy, non-chemical organic food. So we need not only a total change in the direction of our agriculture, we need a total change in our direction of social understanding and a change away from what people so derisively call the nanny state, or towards what people derisively call the nanny state, where we have a government that cares enough about the poor people in this country to ensure that they get actually decent food to eat and decent housing, of course. Two things have to go hand in hand. If we can change our agriculture and if we can get decent food to the people who need it, our health bill will plummet.
Yes. So we do need a nanny state, except let's not call it that.
I don't like that term.
Yeah.
We need a caring state. Let's take away the nanny and just say caring state. We do need a caring state. Absolutely. We've always needed it. We've just been sidetracked from it from the last 20 or more years, 30 years. It's time we got back to having a caring state.
I totally agree with you. Look, it's been really great to talk to you. I really appreciate all that you've been doing for all this long time. And still banging on to the New Zealand government that they need to do things, and working overseas and writing a book. Now, where can we get your books from?
Most of them are available through my website, actually. If not from my website, then the Pan Asia Pacific website, and I will send you a link to that.
And your website is?
www.pananz.net. P-A-N-A-N-Z, Pesticide Action Network, Aotearoa, New Zealand.
.net.
Yeah.
Thank you again, and all the best.
Thank you.
With your work in the future.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks.
Bye.
That was me, Lisa Eyre, talking with Dr. Mariel Watts, and the interview was sponsored by the Awareness Party. You've just been listening to Green Planet on Planet FM. Join us at the same time next week, 8 a.m. Thursdays, or any time online at greenplanetfm.com.
You can listen to Green Planet FM on planetaudio.org.nz at 8 a.m. every Thursday, wherever you are on our planet, and have a complete live stream, and you can then also listen to it for the next 7 days by going to planetaudio.org.nz, English, Green, then Green Planet FM. Then iPod and stream can be obtained 8 hours after broadcasting on greenplanetfm.com, which has a huge database of interviews, close on 400 now in the archive. And you can also subscribe to itunes.com or listen to iHeartRadio. You can follow Green Planet FM on Facebook at facebook.com/greenplanetfm and twitter.com/greenplanetfm. This is Tim Lynch.
And or Lisa Eyre.
In the spirit of Aroha, wishing you a wonderful week. We look forward to being with you next week. I say kia kaha and haere ura. Thank you for tuning into this Green Planet radio show. I trust you have derived both enjoyment and insight as we empower ourselves with a greater understanding of the magnificent, multifaceted world that we inhabit. In these coming times of rapid change, it's going to take raw courage and inner resolve. And so I thank you as we all remain both focused yet relaxed as we challenge the status quo and let go of the old as we energetically co-create the new paradigm. Because I can assure you, every one of you are important now. When you go to bed tonight, ready for well-earned rest and sleep, realize that what you think, feel, and do is part of your unfolding destiny. And when we commit to a higher act of goodwill and or community service, Providence also lines up. So that every conversation we have, every email we send, every phone call we make, and every meeting we attend, that we stand in our power and communicate intelligently, warmly, with integrity, knowing that we are actively shaping a collective future that will benefit all our children and grandchildren, as well as that of a larger community. This is Tim Lynch in Auckland from Nuclear Free New Zealand, and mobilizing unity consciousness, wishing you a stupendous week of heartfelt success. I say bye-bye and haere ura.